Today's May 16th. It's Wednesday morning at the JCC. Shivim Panim, the Milton Scholars Curriculum. We're learning the beginning, of course, of Sefer Shemot, the Book of Exodus. We're now in Unit number 7, which the Milton Scholars Curriculum calls the First Pesach. So, of course, the first thing we do is to open up the Chumash and read the material. And we're going to read material, not only that the unit assigns to us, but also some prior material to get the big picture. So in the Chumash, in the book of Exodus, Shemot, we're in, as my sheets tell us, chapter 11, verse 1, and then 4 to 8. Chapter 11, in the English-only edition of the JPS, is on page 100.
Hold it.
And in the art school, it's on page X, and in the Hebrew English, it's on page Y. In 100. We're on page 100 in the English only. In the English Hebrew, I don't know what page. Chapter 11 of Exodus. So, to give us the framework in the background, we've been through at this point 9 plagues. Paro doesn't know how many plagues it's going to be. I don't know if Moshe knows, but God finally says, we're coming towards the end. And we're reading now the first verse of chapter 11, which reads as follows. I see you're having a problem finding chapter 11. Howard has the art scroll.
Oh, okay.
Anybody know where it is?
Want me to help you there?
That's right. 11?
Yeah.
Chapter 11.
Keep going.
Yeah, they got 25. Okay, we're getting there.
You're just about there.
They're just about there now. Okay.
Okay, the first verse of chapter 11. And the Lord said to Moshe, I will bring but one more plague upon Paro and upon Egypt, and after that he shall let you go from here. Indeed, when he lets you go, he will drive you out of here, one and all. We just read that for background. And now let's read verses 4 to 8 of that same chapter. So God said to Moshe, this is going to be one more plague. And now we have the following. We have Moses telling Paro what God told him. Verse 4. Moses said, thus says the Lord, towards midnight, I will go forth among the Egyptians. Moses didn't say what day it is. He just said what time, but not what day. I will go forth among the Egyptians, and every firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Paro, who sits on his throne, to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstones, and all the firstborn of the cattle. And there shall be a loud cry in all the land of Egypt, such as has never been or will ever be again. But not a dog shall even snarl at any of the Israelites, at man or beast, in order that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between Israel and Egypt. Then all these courtiers of yours shall come down to me and bow low to me, saying, depart, you and all the people who follow you. After that I will depart. And he left Paro's presence in hot anger. That's background. So now Paro knows there's going to be a plague of the firstborn. A terrible thing is going to happen. And Moses leaves the office of Paro. We don't know what Paro is thinking, what's going to happen. And then chapter 12. Chapter 12 is our unit for today, verses 1 to 14. Chapter 12. The Lord said to Moshe and Aaron in the land of Egypt. So this is after Moses has learned about the upcoming 10th plague of the firstborn, but before it happens. Before the plague actually happens. The Lord said to Moshe and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month, the month we're in right now, says God to Moshe, which we know was in the spring. It's the month that today we call Nisan, the month in which we celebrate the holiday of Passover. This month,
thank you,
shall mark for you the beginning of the months. It shall be the first of the months of the year for you. Speak to the whole community of Israel and say that on the 10th of this month, each of them shall take a lamb to a family, a lamb to a household. But if the household is too small for a lamb, if there's not enough people to eat it, let him share one with a neighbor who dwells nearby. In proportion to the number of persons, you shall contribute for the lamb according to what each household will eat. Your lamb shall be without blemish, our yearly mail. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. You shall keep watch over it until the 14th day of this month. And all the assembled congregation of the Israelites shall slaughter it at twilight. They shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and the lintel of the houses in which they are to eat it. They shall eat the flesh that same night. They shall eat it roasted over the fire with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs, with matzah and maror. Do not eat any of it raw or cooked in any way with water, but roasted head, legs, and entrails over the fire. You shall not leave any of it over until morning. If any of it is left until morning, you shall burn it. This is how you shall eat it: your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. And you shall eat it hurriedly. It is a Passover offering to the Lord. For that night I will go through the land of Egypt and strike down every firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and I will mete out punishments to all the gods of Egypt, I the Lord. And the blood on the houses where you are staying shall be a sign for you. When I see the blood, I will pass over you, so that no plague will destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. This day shall be to you one of remembrance. You shall celebrate as a festival to the Lord throughout the ages. You shall celebrate it as an institution for all time. So let's just summarize what we read. The first verse was that this month is going to be a special month, the first month of the months of the year. And then we read the verses that talk about this ceremony that the Israelites are supposed to do while they're in Egypt, while they're slaves, while they're still under the hand of Paro. They're supposed to have this meal, right, of taking the lamb, designating it on the 10th of the month, on the 14th of the month, towards evening, twilight, before the sun goes down, sacrificing it, killing it, putting the blood on the doorpost, and then roasting it and eating it that night after the sun goes down. In other words, on the Hebrew calendar, it's no longer the 14th of the month, it's the 15th because the sun went down. Eating it at night with matzah and maror, with unleavened bread and bitter herbs, together with the meat that they roasted over an open fire. And then it says they're supposed to do all that when they're really ready to move, with their clothes on and their sandals on their feet and their staffs in their hand. And then at midnight, God is going to do that plague that we already heard that Pharaoh knows about, that Moses told him about, the killing of the firstborn. And then the Egyptians are going to throw the Israelites out just as they're completing their meal that night, about midnight. That's the scenario. And in the last verse we just read, verse 14, we're told that this meal is to be a remembrance for all generations. And that's our Seder every year, that we remember the meal. We re-commemorate, we reenact the meal that the Israelites had when they were still slaves. Remember that. They weren't free men and women yet. This meal was a meal they had in slavery. But by the end of the meal, they got a knock on the door that said, "You're out of here. Go quickly." So the questions we have to ask ourselves are many. One question is, what's the connection between this meal, this ceremony, the Exodus on the one hand, and the first verse on the other? The first verse that said, this month will be to you the first month of the months of the year. What's the connection? Why talk about months in the first month when we're talking about getting out of Egypt? Another question we're going to ask is, what's the meaning of this lamb? Why this lamb, and why from the sheep and the goats, and why does it have to be roasted, and why the blood on the doorposts, and why does it have to be eaten whole, etc., etc., etc.? And then we'll also have to ask about the matzah. What's the symbolism of this matzah? Why do they have to eat this unleavened bread? So those are the basic things we want to talk about the calendar, the months, and about the Paschal lamb, and about the matzah. Three separate issues. Here we go. So, our workbook, our Milton Scholars curriculum, has us looking at the commentary of the Ramban, Nachmanides, which is on page 157. 157. It's a pretty famous Ramban, but of course a teacher says anything is famous when he's taught it many times, so that's not a fair thing to say it's famous, but it is famous. So the Ramban, let me remind everyone, is Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman. Moshe ben Nachman. He lives two generations after the Rambam. Everyone knows the Rambam. The Rambam died in 1204. Whereas the Ramban is two generations later in Spain. He's in the 1300s, the mid and late 1300s. mid and late 1200s. Like I said, two generations after the Rambam, and he is certainly one of the greatest Jewish leaders to live after the Rambam, whereas the Rambam was a rationalist, the Ramban was a mystic, a Kabbalist. The Ramban is most famous for his commentary on the Torah. He wrote a commentary on the whole Torah, and that commentary appears in a book I mentioned in the past, the Mikraot Gedolot. Remember the anthology that has the major commentators on the Bible from the Middle Ages, Rashi, the Ramban, the Ibn Ezra, the Sforno. The Ramban is right up there on the page of every Mikraot Gedolot. We'll read. And the meaning of, and this month shall be unto you as the first of your months, right, that's the first verse of our unit, is that Israel should reckon this as the first month. The month of Nisan shall be reckoned as the first month. And beginning with it, the count should proceed to the second and the third until the year is completed with the 12th month, for the purpose that this month shall be a commemoration of the great miracle. For every time we mention the months, the miracle will be alluded to. And indeed in the Torah, there are no names of the months. There's the first month, the second month, the third month, the eighth month, the 12th month, and all begins with the month in the spring that the Exodus took place in, the one we today call Nisan. But that name Nisan doesn't appear in the Torah. And the Ramban is explaining why the months don't have names but numbers, and why the first number, the first month, is the one in the spring, because it commemorates. In this way, every single month of the year commemorates, reminds us of the fact that the Jewish nation was born, our calendar begins, in the spring when we left Egypt. So that's really, according to the Ramban, the meaning of the first verse of our unit today. This month is to be for you the beginning of the month. In other words, whatever calendar it is that the Israelites might have been using at that time, a lunar calendar, a solar calendar, one that began in the spring or the fall or the winter, whatever it might be, from now on you guys, you Jews, have a different calendar. A calendar that reminds you always of this seminal time, this seminal period, this seminal event in Jewish history. It's just like today, at least theoretically, the Western Christian world has a calendar that marks the birth of Jesus. Right? Why does everything begin on the 1st of January? Because supposedly that's when Jesus was born. We know it's not really true. There's some issues there when he was really born, but that's besides the point. Right? So a calendar is the way you organize your whole understanding of culture, your understanding of time. And this is a new idea in human history that later, again, Christian Europe took from the Jews, that you build a calendar upon a central event in the history of the culture or of the nation. And then he says something interesting that perhaps we've never thought about before. He says, it is for that reason that the months do not have names in the Torah, but identified by number. And then he says, and it is similar to the way that days are referenced with reference to the day of Shabbat. The first day of Shabbat and the second day of Shabbat, etc. In Hebrew, in the Bible, not only don't the months have names, but the days of the week don't have names. It's called the first day, the second day, the third day. And what's the first day? It's what we call Sunday. And the second day is Monday. And why is Sunday called the first day? Because it's the first day after Shabbat. And when you get to the sixth day, we in Hebrew, Yom Shishi, the sixth day, we call it Friday in English. The very name of the day reminds you that it's 6 days from Shabbat, and tomorrow is Shabbat. In other words, the whole organization of the week reminds you of meaning. And I'll just tell you, by the way, it's just so disconcerting from, I'm talking about my personal experience, that in the U.S., the week begins on Monday. Because it throws the whole Jewish sense of time off. It gives you the sense that Sunday's the last day of the week. But it, and therefore, Israelis, including me in America, always get it mixed up when someone says, today's Monday, we think it must be Sunday. Because Monday's the first day of the week, so today must be the day after Shabbat. And it just, to me, it so viscerally and so existentially reminds me how a calendar teaches you values. The calendar teaches you values. The way time is organized teaches you values. So we have it both with the days of the week and with the months of the year. The days of the week remind us of Shabbat, and the months remind us of the Exodus, which is to say the birth of the Jewish people from the womb of Egypt.
When were the names of the months, when did they come into being?
The Jewish people received them from the Babylonian culture. The names of the months, yeah. Nisan, Tishrei, Elul, that comes from Babylonia. And the Ramban, as we read on, is going to actually find meaning in that also. So, we'll read on. The Ramban goes on to say, thus, when we call the month of Nisan the first, and Tishrei the seventh, the meaning is the first with reference to the redemption from Egypt, and the seventh with reference to it. And our rabbis have mentioned this matter, and they said that the names of the months came back with us from Babel. In other words, in the Torah, there are no months with names. It's first, second, third, fourth. And that's the way it is throughout the Tanakh, throughout 90% of the Tanakh. But those books of the Tanakh that come after the Babylonian exile, which is only two or three books, the book of Daniel and the book of Esther, those come after Babylonian exile. They have different names. They don't have numbers. They have the names that came from Babylonia. Just to remind everyone when Babylonian exile was. So the Jewish people were exiled from the land of Israel at the destruction of the first temple in the year 586 before the Common Era. And we were in Babylonian exile for 70 years until the beginning of the return. And when the Israelites returned from Babylonia to the land of Israel about 510 before the Common Era, that's 70 years of exile, they brought with them the Babylonian names of the months. And those names are used in the book of Daniel and in the book of Esther in the Bible, which are the latest books.
When did they come back, did you say?
About 510 before the Common Era. Mm-hmm. There's no set date because they came back in small bands,
small
and
numbers,
waves.
Yeah.
So reading in the Ramban, he says, for originally they had no names for us, the months. And the reason is that they were in commemoration of the Exodus from Egypt, as we just read. But when we return from Babel, from Babylonia, and the prophecy of, it will no longer be said by the life of the Lord who took the Jewish people out of Egypt, rather it will be said by the life of the Lord who raised us and brought the people of Egypt from the northern land, which is Babylonia. In other words, Jeremiah prophesies that in the future, Jeremiah is in the end of the first temple. In the future, he prophesies that there will be a redemption for the Jewish people as great as the redemption from Egypt, so that people will no longer say the great God who took us out of Egypt, they'll say the great God who took us out of Babylonia. And indeed, we know that not too many years after Jeremiah prophesied, the temple fell, the first temple was destroyed, the Jews went into exile, but 70 years later, there was the great redemption. And we read on, the prophecy was fulfilled on the last three lines, we changed our practice and began to call the months by the names which were used in those lands, in Babylonia, as a reminder that we had been there, and that it was from there that Hashem took us out. So as if to say, we've changed the system from numbers to names, but the names also have significance. Reminds us that we were once in Babylon exile, and we've been redeemed from there. For these names, Niyah, Nisan, Iyar, and the rest are Persian names, and they appear only in the book of the prophets who prophesize in Babel and in Megillat Esther. That is to say, the book of Daniel. By the way, Persia and Babylon, he's using them interchangeably. Babylon and Persia. Because remember, Babylon conquered us, and brought us into exile, but then the Persians conquered the Babylonians. So Persia, Babylonia became Persia. I know it's confusing, I'm trying to make it as straightforward as possible. And still today, the non-Jews in those lands, in Babylonia and Persia, use the names Nisan and Tishrei, etc., as we do. And thus, we are following the same practice with reference to the second redemption as we did in connection with the first. Right, the first redemption from Egypt is memorialized by the number names of the months, and the second redemption is memorialized by the fact that we use names that came from the country that conquered us and that we were redeemed from. So that's for the Ramban, the beginning of our unit, and it really reminds us, again, how important time is. Time determines cultural orientation and can be so powerful. Now, Professor Nachum Sarna, who passed away just, must be 8 years ago, adds to this. Professor Sarna, I've probably mentioned in this class, was a friend of mine. He taught at Brandeis University for most of his career, and at the end of his career he had to get out of the cold weather of Boston, and his doctor said, go down to Florida with a million other retired Jews, and I happened to be there serving as a rabbi in Boca Raton, so I got to know him, and he kind of took me under his wing, and what can I say, I have a very warm place in my heart for him. So he writes in his book, he has a book on Exodus and a book on Genesis. In his book on Exodus, he writes the following. The capitulation of the Paro following the culminating and inexorable decisive blow, the death of the firstborn, is now at hand. Between the prediction of the impending climax and the account of its realization, the narrative imposes detailed instructions to the Israelites in preparation for their liberation from slavery. A people newly freed must henceforth be sustained by its own narrative resources if it is to achieve true national independence. If it is no longer to be a passive object of history, subservient to a dominant but alien culture, a liberated people must evolve and stress its own distinctive autonomous culture, devise its own structure of national existence, and forge its own institutions. One of its first desiderata is the establishment of a uniform calendar. Such an institution is a powerful instrument of societal, cultural, and religious cohesion. This being so, the Israelites are informed that the month of liberation, the springtime of nature, and now the springtime of Israel as a free people, is henceforth to be the start of the year. This month shall mark off for you the beginning of the months. It shall be the first of the months of the year for you. We know nothing of Israel's earlier calendar, but the phrasing unmistakably points to an innovation, to a break with the past. Now, it's just think of it. Whatever the calendar was at the time, the verses are telling us, according to Professor Sarna, that the Jewish people are going to have their own calendar, their own way of doing things, their own way of looking at time. Everyone else will be, I don't know, in the sixth month of the year, and we'll be in the first month of the year. It cuts you off from the rest of the world to a certain sense, and there's something good about that. And it gives you your own autonomous sense of who you are. And it's not just a capricious sense of who you are, but it's a calendar that actually marks your birth, reminds you all the time of who you are and where you came from. Although the celebration of a festival at this season was quite common in the Near East, the Israelite version belongs to a wholly different character from its contemporaries in that the new year is now grounded neither in nature's renewal nor in mythology, such as an event in the life of a god, but in a historic event, the liberation of a people from national oppression. Such a revolutionary phenomenon is without analogy in the ancient world. And I said earlier that the Christians did the same thing after us, beginning a calendar from a historical event. But Professor Sarna claims that the idea comes from the Bible, that before then, years began based on nature's renewal or based on some mythological event, but not on a historical event. Anyone want to comment? Object? Nothing too much to object to. It's pretty straightforward.
It's interesting. I didn't really realize.
Well, it's interesting how we cut our time. Yeah. You know, it's from here to there, and from there to here, and from after Shabbat till Shabbat, and from so and so many. There's always something holy connected with it. It's the same thing with the holidays, or everything we do.
Right, what Miriam is saying reminds me of the approach and the theory of Abraham Joshua Heschel, who pointed out that many ancient nations and many nations in our time, many cultures, many religions sanctify place, geography. Judaism innovated the idea of the sanctification of time. Time. That one moment of time can be different than another moment of time. Different significance. And of course, that brings us to the idea that time is precious. One moment is gone, it won't come back. The next moment is different. It's a different character. And everyone has its own, every moment has its own meaning.
But we keep our, but by having a extra month every so many years, we keep ourselves in a moon cycle.
In a solar cycle. Right, it's a corrective.
In a solar cycle, yeah. So we don't celebrate the harvest with snow on the ground.
Right, the Jewish calendar is attentive not only to historical time, mm-hmm. but also to nature. But the point is, it's not only nature.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about that. Suppose you are born in Adar 2, the leap months. When do you celebrate your birthday?
Well, you could say, of course, that a person who was born 40 years ago was really only 10 years old.
That's what I'm trying to say.
If you ask when to celebrate the birthday, there's no halachic significance there.
So Stuart's a leap year baby. He celebrates it February 28th and March 1st.
Yes, you do whatever you want. So her husband is already 150 years old.
We're talking about a whole month.
Yeah. What did you expect?
But let me tell you, the halachic question, and this is one that I've read a lot about, is when you say Kaddish for someone who died in a leap year. Right? So that actually has a lot of controversy. That's a halachic question.
How do you handle that on your passport and everything else? I mean, you know, is it going to say on the Israeli passport, Adar 2?
Adar Sheni, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What do the health insurance and life insurance companies do in Israel for
people
like that?
I don't know. Okay.
Statistics.
We're going to go on to commentary number six.
There are commentary.
Commentary number six.
Number six, which is on page 164. And here we're moving to another issue. We're finished with the Ramban and with Professor Sarna on the matter of the calendar, the first verse of chapter 12. We're now moving to the meaning of the Korban Pesach, of the sacrificial lamb. Why do they have to get this lamb? Why do they have to take it on the 10th of the month? Why keep it until the 14th? Why slaughter it? Why roast it on open fire? Why put the blood on the doorpost? Why? So Midrash Rabbah is a Agadic Midrash from almost 2,000 years ago. And it's very short here, and it says as follows, the bottom of page 164. God said to Moshe, as long as the Israelites are serving the gods of Egypt, they will not be redeemed. Go and tell them to leave off their evil deeds and to deny the worship of the gods. As it says in chapter 12, verse 21, a verse we didn't read, draw and take for yourselves. Moses tells the people, draw and take a lamb. And the Midrash says, why two verbs, draw and take? I.e., draw your hands away from idolatry, that's the negative act, refrain, and then take for yourselves, that's the positive act. Sheep and slaughter the gods of Egypt and make the Passover. For in this way, God will pass over you.
Mm-hmm. Would it be more proper to say withdraw and take?
In English, it would come out to be withdraw, exactly. So I want to point out two assumptions that this text makes before we go and discuss its meaning. The first assumption is that the Israelites were idolaters in Egypt. And the second assumption is that one of the gods of the Egyptians is the sheep and the lamb. So let's work out those two assumptions. For the first assumption, that the Israelites were idolaters, just like the Egyptians, we're going to look at the book of Yechezkel, Ezekiel chapter 20. So we can keep our fingers where we are in Exodus and go to Ezekiel chapter 20. And Ezekiel chapter 20, verses 6 and 7, we find the following. In the JPS, it's English only 9:20. 9:20 in the English only. In the Hebrew, I'm not sure. Whoever finds it can shout out. Ezekiel 20. Ezekiel chapter 20. It's after Isaiah. Mm-hmm. It's okay. After Isaiah.
In Isaiah.
Ezekiel 20 is 1192.
1192 in the JPS English Hebrew.
Ezekiel 20.
Verses 6 to 7.
So that's dots.
Verse 6. Yeah. That same day, I swore to them, says God, to take them out of the land of Egypt into a land flowing with milk and honey, a land which I sought out for them, the fairest of all lands. I also said to them, says God, cast away every one of you the detestable things that you are drawn to, and do not defile yourself with the fetishes of Egypt. I, the Lord, am your God. So there it is explicit that the Israelites were idolaters. Most of them, all of them, some of them were idolaters in Egypt. And now to the second assumption, that when they're told to take this lamb, sheep or goat, it's a matter of drawing their hands away from idolatry. So where does the assumption come from that the Egyptians and the Israelites worship the sheep and the goats? Well, it comes from the following. Remember, we're going back in time now. Remember that throughout the nine plagues, Moses is negotiating with Paro. And Moses always saying, let my people go for a three-day holiday in the desert, right? We've talked about that. And Paro first says, no, no, no. And when the plagues get more serious, he says, okay, you can go, but not into the desert, only stay in the land. And at that point, Moses responds, we can't stay in the land because we're going to sacrifice sheep and goats. And if we sacrifice them in the land as opposed to in the desert, the Egyptians will stone us. What do you see from that? That the Egyptians held the sheep and the goats to be holy. So then you put everything together. The Egyptians worship the sheep and the goats, apparently. And the Israelites, looks like, as well did. There's idolatry all around them, and even deep into their own culture and psyche, the Israelites. And then God says, I'm not going to redeem you, not going to take you out of Egypt, not going to pick you out of slavery, unless you first sacrifice, kill the God of the Egyptians, which is an act of the repudiation of idolatry. You have to sacrifice, you have to kill it, you have to draw your hands away from it and say, that's not mine anymore. There has to be a line drawn between the past and the future. You have to be willing to go out in a new direction, says God to the Israelites, and follow the one God. Otherwise, there's no point in redemption, because the redemption is not just about slavery to freedom. It's about a new way of life, a new culture, a new religion. It's about following God. If you're not willing to take that step of the repudiation of idolatry, then there's nothing to talk about.
Imagining that, you know, being a slave for however many years we were slaves, we probably sort of started losing the faith. You know, where's God? You know, how come I'm still a slave? So that's right.
Yes.
How did the Israelites get away with?
They did say that was the point for them to
say. Yeah, but I mean, what I'm saying is nobody caught on. I mean, here they smear all this blood on the doorpost. They must have been wise to it.
And if someone was wise to it, therefore?
We're not killed.
Is it again?
They were not killed.
In other words, there's going to be a conflict. There's going to be...
Yeah, but I mean, if it's the Egyptians' God, if the lamb and the sheep and all this kind of stuff is the Egyptians' God, and now they, in an act of heresy, the Israelites, although they worship these animals, now they kill them and they smear this thing on the... You can't do this kind of thing undetected.
And like Caroline said, that's exactly the point.
They wanted that you were supposed to say that it was a way of actively denying that these were gods.
In other words, in your face.
In your face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be active resistance rather than passive resistance.
Absolutely. Yes.
We're going to risk it.
Risk. There's a risk involved, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a risk involved. You have to be willing to put something on the line here.
You buy
in. In order to be redeemed. You have to buy in.
You buy in.
Right? And just to go back to what Myra brought up, let's remember that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, passed on to their children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren, a certain heritage, a certain vision for the future, a certain belief in God. No mitzvot, no commandments except for circumcision, nothing else. But apparently, throughout the years of slavery, that tradition became weakened, became diluted, and to a large degree, perhaps got even lost. And actually, in the Zohar, in the Book of Jewish Mysticism, there's a very poignant picture of this is the last moment. If the Jews, the Israelites, stay in Egyptian slavery and culture one more year, they'll completely lose what's left of their connection to the past. And God says, this is the point. Let me see if you have any shred left of loyalty. And if you do, you can be redeemed. If not, the game's over. It's do or die right now. So now, on the same subject, there's another commentary brought in our booklet. We're going back to commentary 5, which is going to flesh out a lot of the things we've been saying here. Just going back one page to 163. This is Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, the author of a book called Haktava Kabbalah. And by the way, it doesn't say it here in our workbook, but I'll tell you, he lived in the same town and the same time as Immanuel Kant, if that means anything to you. Yeah. Kant was writing his philosophy and Rabbi Mecklenburg was writing his commentary on the Torah. In truth, there were things in the Israelites themselves that were holding back the redemption. As our rabbis have said, that they were idol worshippers, as the Egyptians. It was God's desire to purify and cleanse them. And so he commanded the offering of the Pesach, of the lamb. Through this, they would absolutely demonstrate that they had repented of their evil ways by slaughtering the very God they were serving. Right? That's the same as we saw in the Midrash. For a sign and an unquestionable signal of a lover's utter love is the fact that he does not allow any fear, right, that's what Bruce just brought up, or concern of danger to enter his heart while fulfilling the wishes of his beloved. Instead, he will place his very life in the other's hand and endanger himself, not holding back from doing the other wishes. So God is basically saying, if you love me, you'll risk your life for me. Of course, perhaps love is not, it's not love yet. But do you have any loyalty to God? Do you have any hope that you can begin a new life with God? Do you have it within you to repudiate the God of the Egyptians? And of course, the 9 plagues were very helpful to the Israelites to repudiate Egyptian culture. They saw what was happening to Egyptian culture. It's not that they love God so much, but this, no other choice. The Egyptian gods are being destroyed.
That gave them confidence.
Right.
Things were going to happen.
Right. It was hard to take God's side, but not that hard. It would have been harder before the 9 plagues. Right. Therefore, God ordered them to perform 3 actions in the slaughter of the God of the Egyptians, and to do so publicly, with much advertisement, and that they should not consider the terrible risk involved in angering the Egyptians by insulting their deity, thereby inciting them to rise against the Israelites to wipe them out, as Moses said. And now he's going to quote the verse that I talked about in the negotiations between Moses and Pharaoh. Could we sacrifice the sacred animal of the Egyptians before their very eyes and not have them stone us? God, I mentioned that verse earlier. So he goes on. First, despite the risk, they would not refrain from fulfilling the desire of the commander, that's God, in the markets and the streets, while reviled and insulted, until bringing the sheep to their homes with much noise and not fearing the Egyptians. So the first thing is that the Israelites were commanded to go take the sheep and bring it home. That itself was a public act, and the Israelites were seen by the Egyptians leading the sheep from the fields and from the pastures to their front yards. That aroused interest and aroused perhaps excitement and aroused opposition. And that's what the Israelites had to do. and they'd be willing to do that. Second, they would slaughter it in groups, and much to do, family by family, with advertisement, and now, too, they would not fear and dread their enemies. Right? We read that groups of people have to get together, Jews have to get together, to slaughter it together. Finally, not enough, all that they had already done, but afterwards also, as they were eating it, they would advertise by placing its blood on the lintels and the doorposts of their homes for every Egyptian passerby to see. So they would know that right now they are consuming the Egyptian deity. And in this day, and in this way, there would be a proof of their complete return to God, and that is what is meant by, and the blood will be a sign for you, will be a sign of your good intentions and your uprightness with God, and in this way it will arouse God's mercy on you, that you should not be destroyed as required by law for having mimicked the Egyptians in the service of the Lamb. The Egyptians, we can think of the Israelites as being culpable for idolatry, but this is their repentance. So, I've mentioned a few times in different frameworks, perhaps Carol Ann remembers this because she's heard me say it so many times, that I have a colleague who describes what we just read in American terms as being commanded to take the American flag, a big one, burn it on your front lawn, and smear the ashes on your front door so everyone could see. It's an act of civil disobedience. And would you do it? It's hard. It means spitting in the face of all your friends, spitting in the face of the people who've been your taskmasters and your those in charge of you for so many decades. It's a very, very difficult thing to do, and it requires loyalty and a certain degree of faith. Civil disobedience.
Okay, but by that time, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
By that time, hadn't they already had a few plagues? The Egyptians have already had seen a few plagues, and so, you know, the Jews were starting to believe that. Okay,
right, that made it easier.
You know, mm-hmm. Big guy's back, you know?
You're right.
I mean, the faith is coming back.
You're absolutely right.
So it gave them a little more empowerment mm-hmm. to do what they needed to do to break the mm-hmm. con.
That's absolutely true.
Have any of the scholars found support that that at times while this rebellion was going on, the Egyptians actually punished or attacked or slaughtered the Israelites?
No, we don't have.
So do we assume that Hashem was protecting them?
Well, we have what Myra just said, right? We have all these plagues. The Egyptians are probably quaking in fear.
Well, for one thing, the firstborn gets slain.
Right, that didn't happen yet. It's about to happen.
That's ultimately coming up. That's pretty tough. I mean, mm-hmm. the Egyptians must have been, this is...
They didn't know about that, but they had nine other plagues.
It's coming.
Yeah, and remember also that after the plague of the firstborn... At midnight, when they're about to leave, the Israelites go to their neighbors and ask to borrow silver and gold, and they're given it readily and quickly because the Egyptians are fearful for their lives. So even though from a psychological and sociological perspective, the Israelites were very afraid, probably, of being killed and derided by the Egyptians for killing the god. Mm-hmm. That's psychologically and sociologically. But practically speaking, probably nothing happened because the Egyptians are afraid.
This is the antithesis of the Arab Spring as we see it today.
Explain what you mean.
Well, I mean, people have gone into the streets and they put their lives on the line, and they get killed. We're seeing this every day. How Assad and mm-hmm. formerly whoever it was who lost his head, they would fight their own people. They would annihilate them.
And that doesn't seem to have happened here.
Yeah, right.
Because whereas the Egyptian Spring, like say in Tunisia, they were depending on the West's firepower, but here the Israelites were depending on God's firepower, and he had more firepower to protect them.
Interesting.
Rabbi, I know this is not a subject for the class, but is there Egyptian history at the same time anywhere recorded that would verify any of this from another perspective?
That's a matter that's greatly debated among scholars. In other words, they debate if the evidence exists or not, because there are certain writings, and it's debated how to interpret them. So we can say, therefore, since there's debate of how to interpret them, that means there's no hard and fast proof that any of this ever took place.
From Egyptian.
Right, there's no extra-biblical proof. That there are those who say there is, but there's an argument about that. There's no hard and fast extra-biblical proof that any of this took place.
I think that in Islam, Moshe is one of their prophets, is it not?
I've heard that. Musa.
Musa. Okay. So, do they report anything about Moshe doing what we
have? I admit my ignorance. It's very easy to look up, I guess.
He's got to be a prophet for some reason, right?
Right. We know he's mentioned in the Quran. I don't know what it says.
But, I mean, what I'm saying is, what I mean, it's almost like he exists in the vacuum. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Unless he's tied up to something.
Well, the fact, let's say that he's mentioned in the Quran and all the things we're talking about are replicated there. That's no proof. The Quran is not historical work. The Quran is a late work. It was only written 1,000 years ago.
Well, right. You know it is what it is.
Okay, so that doesn't prove anything in any direction.
Jesus was a prophet.
I understand that, but
it must come from the same story.
It must come from someplace.
Yeah, from this, probably the same.
So I want to go back to what we're reading, Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, and ask a question. He gives us three examples of how the Israelites had to advertise what they're doing. They had to walk the sheep and the goats through the streets to get them home. And secondly, he says that they had to slaughter it in groups. And thirdly, he says they had to put the blood on the doorpost. All about advertising what they were doing. I want to ask the following question. Bring more proofs. Can you bring more proofs from the verses we read in the Torah in chapter 12 about the advertisement, about the public nature of this? What other things were they commanded to do that might also be for the reason of making it public?
They had to roast it in the front yard or whatever
they
had. Yeah. Right? The fact that they had to roast it, how do they have to roast it? Can you look in the verses? In what form did it have to be roasted?
Whole.
Whole. Right? Whole. You can't divide into pieces and put it in a pot. You have to take the whole thing, roast it on open fire, which means lots of smoke and lots of smell. It means that the whole air of the city is filled with the smell of a barbecue that night. He said, can't be avoided, right? And there's also something else. Remember, the verses said they had to take it on the 10th day, designate on the 10th day, and slaughter it on the 14th. That's 4 days that it's there in the front yard. Everyone sees you've got God in chains, right? So it could be that all of these factors are for that one purpose of making a big deal of it so everyone can see it, advertising the act of civil disobedience that you're doing. So that might be what the Korban Pesach is really about, the sacrificial lamb. And then we get now to the bitter herbs and to the matzah. What are they about? The bitter herbs are simple, right? Bitter herbs are bitter to remind us of the bitterness of slavery. This was the last meal they had as slaves, and it was a meal of a slave, eating the bitter herbs to remind us of the slavery. And then, of course, every year we have this Seder to commemorate the bitterness of slavery. But what about the matzah? So to talk about the matzah, we have 37 minutes. And I decided not to use the commentaries in the workbook because I didn't like them. And I'm going to present my own presentation, which Carol Ann has heard a few times, and I don't know if anyone else in the room has heard.
Maybe I don't know
this.
About now. maybe.
I hear you.
Okay, so we're following the sheets that I prepared, and we're in D. It says the Passover Haggadah. We're going to begin thinking about the matzah by looking at the photocopies on the second and third sides from the Passover Haggadah, and of course from the very famous and venerable Rabbi Maxwell House. I have the first edition. This is a handwritten copy.
And his brother, Mana Shevitz.
So in the beginning of the Haggadah, on the page that says 9 at the bottom, very, very small print, at the top it says in Hebrew, Magid. The very beginning of the Haggadah, it's actually page 8 on the right-hand side, we say, Ha lachma anya, di ahalu av hatana ba'aga de Mitzrayim. English translation, this is the bread of affliction which our ancestors ate in the land of Egypt. And what's important there to notice here are two things. The second thing that's important to notice, we'll get to the first afterwards, is that it says that our ancestors ate it in the land of Egypt. In the land of Egypt, not on the way to freedom, not outside the land of Egypt, but in the land of Egypt. And we'll get back to the meaning of that later. And then it says it's the bread of affliction. Ha lachma anya. This is the bread of affliction. That Aramaic phrase, the second and third words, lachma anya. Lachma is Aramaic for lechem, which is bread. And anya is Aramaic for oni, which is affliction. It's the bread of affliction. Now when you think of what it means, the bread of affliction, it doesn't say the bread of freedom, doesn't say the bread of affluence, the bread of affliction, which is to say the bread of slavery, the bread of poverty, the bread of suffering, which means to say that in some sense, for some reason, matzah symbolizes slavery. Lechem oni, the bread of affliction, lachma anya. It doesn't symbolize freedom. It symbolizes slavery. And I understand now why it's eaten together with the bitter herbs, because they also are about the bitterness of slavery. After saying all that, we turn to near the end of the Haggadah. The next page that I photostat is from near the end of the Haggadah. Whereas after we did the whole mitzvah of what's called Magid, telling the story and reading the Haggadah, we finally point at the Passover lamb, the shank bone, and tell what it is. We point at the bitter herbs, tell what they are, and then we point at the matzah. We lift up the matzah and say what it is. In the middle of page 24, Matzah zo shanu ochlim, this unleavened bread which we now eat. What does it mean? It is eaten because the dough of our ancestors had not time to become leavened. Because the Supreme King of Kings, the Most Holy Blessed be He, revealed Himself unto them and redeemed them, as it is said, they baked unleavened cakes of the dough, matzah, which they had brought forth out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not tarry, neither had they made any provisions for themselves. So that's a quote from a verse in the book of Exodus that says that after they left Egypt, they're fleeing. And they didn't have time for the bread to rise. They left so quickly, they took out dough that wasn't yet risen and wasn't yet baked. And the next morning, as they're fleeing outside of Egypt, they baked it as matzah because they were in a hurry and didn't have time for the dough to rise. And this explanation of matzah is a direct contradiction to the explanation we had 5 minutes ago in the same Haggadah. The first explanation said it's the bread of slavery. It's the bread they ate in Egypt. This explanation says it's the bread that they ate after leaving Egypt, and they ate it as they're fleeing, and therefore what it symbolizes is the flight to freedom. They cooked it now, they baked it now, as it was unleavened, because of the flight to freedom. And therefore it seems that within the Haggadah there's a contradiction.
Is there, correct? Is there a contradiction? Because I am not a cook or a chef as my wife is, but you have a recipe that tells you how to prepare the dough that you're going to ultimately bake.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the Israelites were eating matzah long before the Exodus. It was the daily bread.
Why? Yeah, why would they be eating that? I mean, there was time for the bread to leaven.
For the bread to, well, but they didn't do it. That was the custom. It was the hometown way to bake bread.
Pesach. Why would you eat lamb on Pesach?
These are all the questions that I want to talk about. These are all the right questions.
Eating it before. If they were eating it before, why would they eat it? Why would
Because that's the only
Why would it remind you? You had it before. You had it yesterday. Now you're having it today.
Look, you're running for your life, and you stop to eat, and you say, my dear, I'm hungry, I want a sandwich. So Mama heats up a rock and throws and flaps the
dough
on it.
It's all good what you're saying. Yeah. I want to flesh this out inside the verses.
You know, this is the first time in my almost 80 years I have ever really understood this.
Okay, so now we're doing well. We're at the beginning of understanding. Let's go further. So what we have is this contradiction in the Haggadah. On the one hand, matzah is the bread of slavery, the bread of affliction. On the other hand, it's the bread of freedom. On the first hand, was eaten in Egypt. And the second hand was eaten on the way out when they've already left. Which is it? Of course, the answer is it's both. Matzah seems to have a double meaning and a double significance. We have to understand why it has a double meaning and double significance, where it comes from. And we're now going to see that it's not that the Haggadah made this up, but rather the Torah itself gives a contradictory picture of matzah, a double picture of matzah. So let's go through the verses. Opening up the book of Exodus. Opening up the book of Exodus to chapter 11 and 12, where we were when we began an hour ago. And remember, in the English only, it's on page 100.
11 and 12.
Verses, chapter 11 and 12. And in the Hebrew, it's on page, I don't know. 134.
Which page are you
134, dear.
So it's chapters 11 and 12. Let's remember what we read there just an hour ago. We read that the ceremony of eating the unleavened bread, the bitter herbs, and the paschal lamb is taking place after the ninth plague, before the tenth plague. It's taking place on the night that when it strikes midnight, the tenth plague will occur. The first one will be killed, and the Egyptians will throw the Israelites out. That means that they're eating this matzah with the bitter herbs and with the maror before they leave.
Right.
Before the verse is written that says they didn't have time to bake bread, so it turned out matzah. So that means they're commanded to eat matzah before the historical events happened that made matzah the bread of freedom. That sentence is clear?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore matzah, the matzah of the Seder, the matzah of that first Seder, must have a different significance than the significance that later acquired by the bread not rising as they're fleeing. So what is that other significance? Well, it's probably very simple. And I hinted to that earlier. It's eaten together with the bitter herbs. What do the bitter herbs symbolize? The bitterness of slavery. It must be, therefore, that the matzah they ate that night before they left Egypt was the matzah of slavery, was the matzah of lechem, only the bread of affliction. And as Bruce said, they must have been eating that for all the years they were in Egypt. Why? Why would a slave eat matzah? Any suggestions?
Well, it was easy. It was fast.
Easy and fast.
Didn't have time to
make it rise.
Cheap and accessible.
And it's cheap and accessible, right? There are two different points here, and they're all right. Number one, it's cheap and accessible. All you need is flour and water, no spices, no sugar, no salt, no taste. It's very cheap. If you think of this as food that the taskmasters, the Egyptians, are giving their slaves, so the easiest thing to give your slaves, the cheapest thing, is to give them matzah. And it lasts a long time. And it's very filling.
It's gone like a filler.
Mm-hmm. And if...
thinking about this, it gives a different interpretation of... during Passover, when we eat matzah for a whole week, we think of it as of the freedom, but we also can think of it as of slavery and how they felt during all the time they were enslaved, and that's what they ate on
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Thinking about that as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So now let's think, in addition to the element of matzah, that it's cheap and it's simple and it's tasteless and it's like cardboard, no spice, it's about slavery. if you would think of a different scenario, perhaps it wasn't that the Egyptians gave the Israeli slaves food, but rather the slaves had to make their own food. Mm-hmm. If they have to make their own food with no time to make it, mm-hmm. again, matzah. Mm-hmm. From that aspect, the matzah is the bread of slavery, not so much because it's tasteless, but because it symbolizes that your time is not your own. Mm-hmm. Your time is not your own. So on two levels, we can see symbolically that matzah is a plausible symbol of slavery because it's tasteless and it has no spice to it and it's just so primitive and basic. And number two, because it symbolizes that your time is not your own. And therefore, when they're commanded to eat matzah and maror, unleavened bread and bitter herbs, at this Seder meal, what it really is a symbolic embodiment of 210 years of suffering. That last meal, it's to be their last meal as slaves, a symbolic embodiment of 210 years of suffering, which means every year when we have our Seder, we are re-experiencing the very, very tasteless life of a slave. Bitter herbs and matzah. And actually, the halakha gives expression to both of these aspects of matzah as the bread of affliction, the bread of slavery. And I brought in the sheet here. In G, two different passages from Masechet Psachim, Tractate Psachim. The first one on page 36a says, why does the Torah say lechem oni? Why does the Torah say that the matzah is the bread of affliction? To exclude dough kneaded with wine, oil, or honey. What that means is that when we sit down to the Seder and you have your matzah, the fact that the matzah is not leaven, not chametz, is not enough to make it matzah. If it has any taste to it, it's disqualified. It has to be without wine, oil, or honey. You can't have chocolate-covered matzah. You can't have matzah that's made with salt or honey or any type of spice. Any spices render it invalid because it has to be tasteless. It has to be disgusting. It has to be cardboard. That's the meaning of it. It's the bread of affliction.
No good.
And I'm not saying it's no good because it's chametz. I'm saying it's no good because it has a good taste.
Good taste.
A better taste.
It's supposed to have a bad taste.
Yes, that's it.
Right?
You know, those of us who have been fortunate to travel around the world and have been to many countries where there's abject poverty, they don't eat bread. They eat this. They don't eat bread as, you know, by going... eat bread at Eatsies or bread at Central Market. They eat flat, tasteless. Cardboard.
It's the same thing in South America.
All through Africa. In China they eat flat rice cakes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
I think it's
the interesting thing that I hear is that what we've regarded only as a time issue is much broader than that.
Right.
In other words, they were eating that all along, and it's not the bread of affliction just because it was they didn't have time when they left. They had to eat it before too as well.
Very, very probably.
That's a whole
right.
new
that's
dimension.
That's a suggestion.
You know, that's a whole new dimension.
I have never. It has never been presented
that way.
So that's the suggestion that they ate matzah for 210 years. It symbolizes slavery both because it's tasteless and because it shows that your time is not your own. And this is the final meal of slavery with the matzah and the bitter herbs just a few hours before they go from slavery to freedom at the moment of the plague of the firstborn. Let's read the other...
It's more amazing that they survived. Eating it for a week.
Well, if they ate it,
so look at the second Sakim.
Pages
115 to 116. Mesechet Pesachim, and here it says Lechem Oni. What is the way of the impoverished? And that's the word Ani. Ani and Oni are the same word. He fuels the oven his wife bakes. So here also, he fuels the oven his wife bakes. You probably don't understand what that is trying to say. It's trying to say the following. That if you're really, really impoverished, and you have no money at all, you don't even have enough money to fuel the oven for more than a few minutes. Mm-hmm. You can't put the wood in and wait for it to get really hot and then put the bread in and take it out and shut off the oven. You can't do it. You don't have enough money to burn more than half a log. So what you do is one person fuels the oven, and while that person is fueling the oven, it's just heating up. You already put in. Someone else already puts in the dough. And the idea is it has to be really quickly to save as much resources as possible. Mm. And what the source is saying is the following. That we, when we bake matzah, we have to bake it fast, not merely in order to prevent it from rising. That's not the only reason. Rather, you have to bake it quickly to reenact the way they must have done it when they were slaves in Egypt.
So that's the 18-minute matzah?
No. 18 minutes is to prevent it from becoming leaven. Okay. But the halakha is, you have to do it quickly, even if you could have done it within 18 minutes by working slowly. I didn't say that clearly, did I?
No, I understand.
I'll say it differently. The truth is that to bake a little bit of matzah in 18 minutes, you can work very, very slowly. 18 minutes is a long time. If you take this, you take one little teaspoon, or one little cupful, let's say, of flour, mix it with water, make dough, put it in the oven, and get matzah out of it, you can do that in 7 minutes. Mm-hmm. 18 minutes is a long time. The halakha is you have to do it quickly, not just within 18 minutes. You have to do it as quickly as possible. And the reason is not to prevent it from becoming leavened. The reason is because you have to reenact the way slaves would bake their bread, which is, I don't have any time to do anything. It's quick.
Get back to work.
And then get back to work. So the halakha is that matzah has to be number one without spice, and number one baked quickly, because from these two aspects, you have to symbolize slavery, that it's tasteless, there's no luxury in life, there's no spice in life, it's just the grind, and number two, it has to be done quickly because slaves don't have any time on their hands. Myra.
Shmur matzah meet those criteria?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, because it is tasteless.
Great.
Yeah. Bad. I like other matzah. I can't think.
So now, we have established one side of the equation, that matzah is lechem oni, the bread of affliction, as it says at the beginning of the Haggadah. But what about now the other aspect of things, that matzah is also, we said, the bread of freedom, because when we left, we didn't have time for the bread to rise. So now we're going to go through some verses and see how this whole thing plays itself out and fleshes itself out. So on my sheet, we're looking at E. We've looked at 1 and 2 already. We're going to look now at Exodus 12, 15 to 20. Everyone have the place? Exodus 12, 15 to 20. And remember that verse 15 comes after verse 14, which came after 13, which came after 12. What I mean to say is that in verses 1 to 12, God said, Moses, have this ceremony, have this meal, as you're about to leave Egypt. And then it said in verse 14, we'll read 14 again, this day shall be to you one of remembrance. You shall celebrate as a festival to the Lord throughout the ages. Celebrate is an institute for all time. That's what we have to say there. We do that meal once every year. Good. Verses 15 now to 20. 7 days shall eat unleavened bread. On the very first day shall I remove leaven from your houses. Forever eats unleavened bread from the first to the seventh day. That person shall be cut off from Israel. So here's another matter. Not just a Seder with matzah, Pesach and Maror, but also have a 7-day holiday of not eating bread. You have to eat only unleavened bread. And then it goes on to say, I won't read all the verses. Verse 17 I'll read. You shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread from this very day I brought you out of Egypt. Verse 18, the first month, the 14th day of the month, at even, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month, 7 days. No leavened bread in your houses. Good. Fine.
Why at the end of verse 15?
Verse 15?
That person shall be cut off from Israel.
Okay, this is punishment for eating bread.
Oh, that's the punishment.
That's called karet in Hebrew.
Karet, okay.
So now I'm going to try and do this quickly so I don't go over time too much. I want us to realize now that we've read about God telling Moses about two different celebrations. One is the meal on the night before the plague, and that meal should be celebrated for all generations. A second matter that God's telling Moses is a seven-day holiday of not eating bread. Two separate things. Now, when does that seven-day holiday begin? At the same time as the meal. It begins on the night of the 14th of Nisan. So the seven-day holiday overlaps with the meal, but it's still separate. There's the meal and the seven-day holiday. Conceptually, they're two different things. They overlap, but they're two different things. Now, let's see what Moses tells the Jewish people. All this was God telling Moses. So now we're going to go to Moses passing on to the Jewish people. Look at verse 21 of this same chapter. We're reading where we just left off. Moses then summoned all the elders of Israel and said, go pick out lambs for your families and slaughter the Passover offering. Okay? And although it doesn't say everything Moses said, we can assume he said, Passover offering, the matzah, the bitter herbs, the whole thing, you have to have it on that night. And it says the end of verse 22, none of you shall go outside the door of his house until morning, right? You can be at home while the plague is raging outside. For when the Lord goes to smite the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the lintel to doors, but the Lord will pass over the door and let not the destroyers enter and smite your homes. And then we'll read a little bit more. You should observe this institution for all time, for your descendants. What is it to observe? What he just told them, the meal. Just the meal. When you enter the land of Israel, and your children ask you, what do you mean by this? You shall say, it's the Passover to the Lord, because he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but saved their homes. The people then bowed low in homage. The Israelites went and did so, as Lord commanded. The point is that Moses told the Israelites to have this meal on the 14th of the night, and then the sun goes down and becomes the 15th, with the bitter herbs and the matzah and the maror, and Moses did not tell them about the seven-day holiday. Did not mention the seven-day holiday. Okay? Now let's follow the chronology. What happens now? We get to the very next verse, 29. In the middle of the night, the Lord struck all the firstborn. Okay? And the plague happened. I'm going to skip some verses. Paro summoned Moses, said, get out of here, go quickly. Right? I don't want things bad to happen. Verse 33. The Egyptians urged the people on, impatient to have them leave the country, for they said, we are all dead. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, their knitting bowls wrapped in their cloaks upon their shoulders. The Egyptians had done Moses' bidding and borrowed from the Egyptians objects of silver and gold and clothing. The Lord had disposed the Egyptians favorably to the people and let them have their request, for they stripped the Egyptians. The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children, moreover mixed multitude, but went to them. Verse 39. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough that they had taken out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, since they had been driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. So now, listen to what I'm going to say. I am plausibly presenting the following scenario. For 210 years, the slaves ate matzah. It was tasteless. It was like cardboard without spice. It was made very quickly. Their time was not their own. And now, they're about to leave from slavery to freedom. They had a meal, which we call the Seder, of matzah and maror, and the Passover lamb. And I would suppose that if I had been a slave under those circumstances, and I had been commanded by God to have this final meal in slavery, including the Pesach lamb and the maror and the matzah, that I would be saying to myself, tomorrow we're going to have for breakfast bread. Because we've never been allowed to have bread. The Egyptians prevented it from us. We didn't have enough time. We didn't have the wherewithal. We didn't have the resources. Tomorrow we will be free men and women. Our time will be our own. We can do whatever we want. And tomorrow morning, as free men and women, we're going to bake bread. And I can imagine as a dream, as a vision, wow, we're finally going to taste what we've seen in the Egyptian homes, what we've seen in their bakeries, the smells, the beautiful smells of the spice and the honey and the sugar in those in those cupcakes and those cookies and the delicious breads. We've never had it before. Tomorrow, we shall have bread. And then, the wheels of history turn in such a fashion that they, the next morning, don't have time to make any bread. They end up eating matzah, the same foodstuff that they had as slaves for 210 years, the same foodstuff that symbolizes slavery, ends up being the first meal as free men and women. It's in a certain sense quite perverse and quite disappointing that they have to eat matzah not just as slaves but also as a free nation, so that matzah now becomes the symbol of freedom. The symbol of slavery now became the symbol of freedom because they didn't have time for their bread to rise for their first meal as free men and women. That's the source of the contradiction in the Haggadah. That the Haggadah says that matzah is the bread of slavery, and then it says it's the bread of freedom. Two different places in the Haggadah as we saw. Because in the Torah, it's both. It begins as the bread of slavery, and becomes, through the historical quirk that they had to leave so quickly, I call it a quirk, but it was really engineered by God, it ends up that the bread of slavery turns into the bread of freedom. And I want to show you something really fascinating. Now look at this. We're going to read on a little bit further. We read now chapter 13. Right? Everything the reading is in order. So now they left Egypt. They've eaten their matzah as free men and women because the bread didn't rise. And then chapter 13. We're going to read it from verses 1 to 12. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, consecrate to me every firstborn, etc. And then verse 3, Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you went free from Egypt, the house of bondage, how the Lord freed you from it with a mighty hand. No leavened bread shall be eaten. You go free in this day in the month of Aviv. So when the Lord has brought you into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Hivites, Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give your land flowing with milk and honey, you shall observe in this month the following practice. 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. On the 7th day shall be a festival to the Lord, etc., etc., etc. Don't have to read any further. What the point I want to make is as follows. Moses now tells them of the 7 days only after they've left and not before. And the reason is as follows. The 7 days is a holiday that reminds them of freedom. Why can't you eat bread on the 7 days, but rather matzah? Because their bread didn't have time to rise as they left for freedom. So now we eat that bread of freedom for 7 days. Why did Moses not tell them about the 7-day holiday until they became free? Now listen to the sentence I'm going to say. Moses didn't tell them about the holiday because the historical event that created the meaning of the holiday didn't happen yet. The historical event was leaving quickly, so the bread didn't have time to rise. And then Moses says, we commemorate that by a 7-day holiday of not eating bread, but rather matzah. So everything fits in the following fashion. For 210 years, they ate bread as slaves. God commands to say the meal.
Matzah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
210 years, they ate matzah. The lechem oni, the bread of affliction. God commands to say the meal, the last meal, as slaves, in which they have the Passover sacrifice, which symbolizes, we said, the repudiation of idolatry, and they eat it with the matzah and the bitter herbs to remind them of the slavery they've been through. And in the minds of these slaves, this is the last time in the world they're ever going to eat matzah, because tomorrow we're going to be free and we're going to have
bread.
And then God says, this meal you have to have every single year as a commemoration, and we all know it's the commemoration of slavery. And they don't know yet about any seven-day holiday. Moses didn't tell them. Moses refrained from telling them for a very good reason. Because of what's about to happen. What happens? They leave in the middle of the night, quickly, with haste. The bread doesn't have time to rise. The dough remains flat. They have to eat matzah. It turns out their first meal as free men and women is matzah, so that the bread that was the bread of affliction turns now into a symbol of the bread of a freedom. And then Moses says to them, now that you've eaten matzah in your flight to freedom, I'm going to tell you every year to have a seven-day holiday to commemorate freedom. And in that seven-day holiday, you eat matzah as the bread of freedom. It turns us as follows. The matzah of the Seder is the bread of slavery. The matzah of the 7 days is the bread of freedom. It's so simple, except for the fact that the 7 days begin while the Seder is going on. Right? So when you sit down to the Seder, you're celebrating two different holidays. You're celebrating the Seder holiday, and you're celebrating the 7 day holiday. The matzah of the Seder is the bread of affliction. The matzah of the 7 days is the bread of freedom. But when you're sitting down to the meal of the Seder, it's the second holiday as well as the first. It's the Seder, but it's also the beginning of the 7 days. And that's why the matzah that we eat that night at the Seder is a double-pronged matzah. The matzah that goes together with the bitter herbs, the matzah of the Seder per se, is the bread of affliction. The matzah of the 7 days that we're also eating that night is the matzah of freedom. That's why the Haggadah says it has a double meaning, because it does. Mm-hmm. It does have a double meaning.
Is there any literature saying that this is a second test on the part of God when he tells Moses that there will be a 7 day holiday, but you got the same menu that you had before? God brought us out. You're happy. You're in the land of milk and honey now, but you're gonna have to again eat cardboard for another week.
So you know what? Yes. Not as a test, but as a message, as a philosophical and theological message. And with that, I'd like to end. So what we have here is something very paradoxical, that the symbol of freedom is identical to the symbol of slavery. And that has to cause us to think, why should it be? We would think that the symbol of freedom, the symbol of slavery, should be two different things. The symbol of slavery should be matzah. The symbol of freedom should be bread, because bread is tasty, and especially because bread rises. Bread symbolizes your time as your own. So why shouldn't it be that matzah is slavery and bread is freedom? And I think there's actually an answer to that question. The message seems to be that you should not think of freedom as an unbridled situation of everything is in your hands. Your time is your own, you can do whatever you want. I always like to say that my personal experience is that the freedom of vacation turns into slavery. When I have a schedule, when I have rules and regulations, when I have a framework, I end up doing what I really think is important to do. I accomplish my goals. When I go on vacation and my time is my own, sometimes you end up not being able to control yourself to do what you really want to do, and you end up just wasting your time. And the Torah perhaps is saying that were we to symbolize freedom as bread, we'd be getting across a message that there's all the time in the world. There's no framework, there's no foundation, there's no rules and regulations. But that's not real freedom. Because when there's new rules and regulations, we tend to becoming slaves to our passions, to our baser character, to advertising, to other people's whims. When do we really do what we want to do? When we set up a system of slavery for ourselves. I use a harsh word, slavery for ourselves. Let me give an example. You really want to lose weight. What's the way to do it? To say, tomorrow I'll do whatever I want. Or to go to Weight Watchers and get a very, very rigid system that allows you to free yourself from the slavery to your hunger and your passion and your habit. It turns out that the rules and regulations of Weight Watchers free you to do what you really want, what you really desire, what your inner desire is. The rules and regulations of Weight Watchers release you from the slavery to your hunger, to your passions, to your habits, from your slavish slavery to advertising. We need a certain degree of slavery to a framework to free us to do what we really want to do.
Oh, you're talking about discipline, not slavery.
Right. Very good. I'm purposely using the word slavery, but I mean discipline.
Structure.
I mean structure.
That's slavery.
In other words, freedom has to have structure. And my claim is, that's why freedom is symbolized, not by bread, but by matzah. Because matzah says, time is limited. Time is structured. Time is a framework. You can't just say, I have all the time in the world. You can't just say, I'm going to do whatever I want. When you feel freedom in the sense of absolute, boundless time, you don't end up being free. You end up being enslaved to passion.
Why do you think it was for 7 days?
I don't know. Seven is just a number that has other significance. Look at what Martin Buber said here at the very bottom of our page, and this will have to end. Martin Buber, number 4, wrote that freedom is not a matter that can be actualized according to any whim, arbitrarily. Rather, the central meaning of freedom and its very purpose is the fulfillment of an ideal. And therefore, to sum everything up, the Torah is saying that the move from slavery to freedom is not the move from matzah to bread. It's not the move from a framework that forces you to do things in a certain time frame to a lack of a framework in which you can do things in any time frame. No. The movement from slavery to freedom is the movement from a time frame that is imposed upon you by a foreign human tyrant to a time frame that's imposed upon you by God. Freedom also has an imposition of a time frame. It's not bread, it's matzah. That true freedom is when you're given a framework in which to live your life that allows you to actualize what you really want to do, so you're not a slave to the passions and to laziness and to habit and to everything else that's on the side of you. So the end result of this whole thing is that freedom is symbolized by matzah, that there has to be a framework of life to which you commit yourself. Okay.